Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell and today we're talking diverticulitis. My guest is Amy Sweeney, a nurse researcher at Griffith University and the Gold Coast Hospital Emergency. She and her colleagues have written a narrative review of diverticular disease, which recommends a few changes to practice. Welcome, Amy. What is diverticulitis and how is it diagnosed?
Diverticulitis is inflammation or infection of the diverticula. So diverticula are actually pouches. They usually occur in the sigmoid colon. When a pouch like this happens in your diverticulum, stool can get trapped inside of it, causing inflammation and sometimes infection as well. To diagnose this, obviously a history and physical exam, you would find some tenderness in the lower left quadrant. The patient might have a fever,
yes,
possibly a low-grade fever. The patient would also be complaining of pain and possibly changes in their bowel habits. So even some blood in their stool might be evident.
And what's the worst-case scenario? What if diverticulitis goes untreated? What's the bad news?
So the worst that can happen is that the stool can actually protrude through the diverticulum, causing peritonitis and sepsis. So that obviously is an emergency and must get acted upon immediately with surgery.
How prevalent is diverticulitis? Who gets it? And what burden does it represent to the healthcare system?
Well, it's the most common cause of bleeding, mild bleeding, in adults in developed countries.
And is that about our diet?
Potentially, although the evidence around diet is inconclusive. Diverticulitis occurs only in about 1 to 2 per 1,000 population.
Yep.
However, the known risk factors are increasing age, and obesity. So as those two things increase in our society, the incidence of diverticulitis is also increasing. The predisposition to diverticulitis requires diverticula, which are those pouches. And as we get older, those become quite common, and this is found by autopsy reports. So up to 80% of people aged 85 and older will have those diverticula. Wow. But that doesn't mean they're going to get diverticulitis.
Sure.
So that's probably up to between 10 and 25% of those patients will then develop diverticulitis.
Right. And what is it that changes diverticulitis into diverticulitis?
The pathophysiology actually is not very well understood. So basically, there have been thoughts that it's your diet, that it's, you know, a high-fiber diet might prevent diverticula from forming or from stool getting caught in the pouches. But, however, that's inconsistent finding.
Okay.
So we actually really don't know. And that is an area where more information would be helpful.
Do we know what percentage of diverticulosis turns into diverticulitis?
About 4%, really.
Okay. And does that vary with age as well?
Yes, increasing with age.
What's the difference between complicated and uncomplicated diverticulitis?
Okay, well, those are just terms that depend on basically what you find on an initial CT scan. Uncomplicated diverticulitis means that there aren't any signs of abscess.
Right.
Or perforation, or even to stricture, which is a closure, or fistula. The way that you identify that in the initial presentation would be through a CT scan. So CT is considered the gold standard for diagnosing complicated versus uncomplicated diverticulitis. Only about 15 to 20% of cases will actually be considered complicated.
So is there a difference between how those two things are treated? I imagine that uncomplicated would be much more of a wait and see, would it? Or is there something that can be done at that stage?
Well, that's the whole reason actually that we've done this review is that historically uncomplicated diverticulitis was treated quite aggressively. Patients that came in with symptoms, even mild symptoms, would get admitted to hospital and put on IV antibiotics for 2 to 3 days, put on bowel rest, so IV fluid basically out of commission for 2 to 3 days. And that was actually still commonplace when we did our audit of our local practice.
And what's the problem with that?
Well, the problem with that is obviously this is too aggressive of a treatment, and there are risks, of course, with antibiotics. There are social risks to patients who are kept in hospital for days when they really could be back at home being managed conservatively. Hospitalization isn't necessarily a good thing.
I'm talking today with Amy Sweeney, a nurse researcher from Griffith University, about all things diverticular. Her narrative review can be found at mja.com.au. If you would like to submit an article for publication, go to our homepage and click on the tag called For Authors, or you can send an email to mja@mja.com.au. Back to our chat.
Thing.
Was that why you decided to do a review of the guidelines?
Well, basically, as one of my roles is supervising medical students, so we had a medical student that was wanting to help us with our Choosing Wisely campaign within our hospital, and we asked them to go find out what kind of imaging was recommended for diverticulitis. That's kind of started the whole investigation of our practice, and not just our practice, but national practices around how we manage this condition.
So if hospitalisation isn't appropriate necessarily for uncomplicated, what is for uncomplicated diverticulitis?
So basically the recent evidence, and this is based on randomised controlled trials and meta-analysis of those, and including a Cochrane systematic review, is that, first of all, antibiotics are really not indicated for uncomplicated diverticulitis, unless, of course, you know, there is some other reason that they require antibiotics, such as immunosuppression. The alternative treatment to hospitalization, of course, is going home, keeping to a clear liquid diet for 2 to 3 days, and then progressing to a low-fiber diet just to kind of prevent hard stool formation. And, of course, pain relief is important. Yes. And that pain relief can be simple analgesics, acetaminophen, and antispasmodics.
That's a fairly significant change in practice, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's really only come to light in the last 5 to 10 years. So that's why I think that a lot of countries are still practicing the old ways. And a recent review similar to this review was published in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, basically stating the same things, that uncomplicated diverticulitis does not require inpatient treatment or, in most cases, antibiotics.
So when it comes to complicated diverticulitis, has anything changed in terms of the gold standard there?
Not really. No, that's still obviously a medical emergency.
Yeah.
It might involve surgery, although most commonly some abscesses can be drained percutaneously. So it's actually, again, it hasn't changed as dramatically as for uncomplicated diverticulitis. However, there are changes in that you don't just knee-jerk surgery after 2 recurrences of diverticulitis. Now they basically go by the patient tolerance of those cases of diverticulitis. So recurrence of diverticulitis occurs between 15 to 30% of patients, but normally the recurrent episodes aren't as bad as that initial one.
For the GPs listening out there, what's your recommendation when it comes, you know, if they're sitting in their surgery and a patient comes in and they suspect diverticulitis, what's your recommendation for their management plan?
Okay, well, if it's a patient that they know has had bouts of diverticulitis before, then they don't necessarily need a CT scan for that patient. So only if they're concerned that there might be more sinister pathologies at play, if they're worried that the symptoms are severe enough that the patient might have perforated their bowel or have abscess, large abscess.
Right.
Because, again, diverticulitis is not always caused by infection. So diverticulitis is inflammation of the diverticula, and inflammation doesn't require antibiotics. The GP, again, basically send them home if they're uncomplicated and their symptoms are manageable with simple analgesics. Send them home on a low-fiber diet, clear liquids firstly, and then if, of course, they're not improving after a few days or it's getting worse, then they might want to send them in for some CT imaging to make sure there's nothing more sinister. Well, obviously, this is fairly recent evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Our old ways were based on studies from the 1970s and the 1990s. So now I think it's time to also look at what's on some of our national websites for patient education. And so the patients also become aware that antibiotics aren't always needed. Again, some people go into the GP and they think, okay, well, they did nothing for me. I didn't get an antibiotic. They're not doing a scan. So changing expectations of our patients is also important. And I'm hoping that this review in the podcast and associated media will not just give impetus to GPs and ED doctors to change practice, but also for our professional bodies to look at what we've got on our internet for our patients.
Thanks for your time,
Very
Amy.
Very good. Okay. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
No problem. Thanks a lot. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.